from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In a speech yesterday to the United States Chamber of Commerce, President Obama, echoing the famous words of President Kennedy, said that improving things for America is a two-way street.
But as we work with you to make America a better place to do business, I'm hoping that all of you are thinking what you can do for America.
We'll discuss the president's speech in the hour ahead and what it means for the likelihood of a different and more symbiotic relationship between business and the government and his present administration. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Emphasizing amending offenses between business and government, President Obama delivered a speech yesterday to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in which he said both sides needed to be more responsible for the nation's economy and also need to work together toward investment in America's future. The president promised to improve the nation's tax code and government regulations to give business more ability to grow, and he announced the formation of a new Council of Business Leaders. He also defended his health care and financial regulatory policies and urged CEOs to increase job hiring and let go of some of the $2 trillion piling up on their balance sheets. In this morning's opening hour of Forum, we focus on the president's speech and the ongoing question of how government and business will interact with each other in enhancing and expanding the nation's economy or fail to do so. Joining us first is Ginger Liu, who is senior counselor to the White House National Economic Council. She's with us this morning from the nation's capital. And Ginger Liu, good to have you with us. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
I guess the place to begin is what you hope will be accomplished by this speech, or what the administration hopes will be accomplished by this speech. Relations have certainly been, well, characterized perhaps best as chilly, and there were $32 million that business spent on really the last election against the president, or at least against the Democratic Party. What do you hope will come out of this?
The purpose of the speech is to build on the State of the Union message, which was to signal the administration's desire to work closely with business leaders to not only improve the business climate, to encourage them to make the investments to increase hiring, but also to recognize that that we need to work together on a wide variety of issues, whether it's the free trade agreements with South Korea or working on tax cuts, et cetera.
Working together, how does the administration envision that actually happening? I mean, give us a sense maybe of a scenario of, particularly with something like the tax code, how business would be working with the government.
Well, with the establishment of the council led by GE CEO Emmett, it's really an opportunity to create a forum for business leaders to come together and solicit ideas, suggestions on whether there are tax provisions that need to be revised, whether there are regulatory issues that need to be streamlined. But the point is to really to create an opportunity for dialogue and to exchange those ideas so that we can start working on how to solve some of these hurdles together.
So this is going to be the President's Council, a conversation for overcoming some of the impediments, or what perhaps business sees particularly as the impediments to moving forward economically.
Well, you know, it's like a family. It's had a little bit of a spat, and now we're having the family council come together and say, hey, you know, we've all got to live together and work together, and we are part of the same family. We are part of we are all part of America. And so we need to start that discussion and then actually find ways to move that agenda together.
What has been, in your judgment or in the administration's judgment, the major reason for this family squabbling or this enmity, if one could even stretch it to that? Because certainly many people feel the administration has been overly friendly toward business, rescuing the auto industry and the TARP policies and so forth.
Well, as you know, when the administration came into office, we inherited one of the deepest economic crises in our generation's memory. And there were a lot of moving parts associated with that contributed to that crisis, whether it was the financial institutions, whether it was large businesses that may have made some inappropriate or less than best business decisions. But the point was, you know, we need to stabilize the infrastructure in order to allow us to work on the more specific questions as we go forward. And I think the evidence seems to show that we are on the right path forward with the financial institutions becoming healthier, with some of the major auto manufacturers coming back to life, with some of our own, you know, other large businesses racking up record profits. They've had to engage in some serious cutbacks and become more productive. But now, I think the time has now come for them to make the investments that in businesses here in America to create the jobs that we need here.
Well, the president certainly made a plea for investing not only in hiring more, but in investing in the infrastructure. What do you think have a sense of the pulse of what the business community's response is to that call?
Well, you know, I mean, there were some interviews of some of the leaders of places like Corning, plans to spend $300 million to expand its R&D center in New York, but it also plans to spend $800 million in liquid display, you know, factories in China and in Taiwan. So, you know, we need to work with them to identify those hurdles to encourage them to build those facilities here in the United States so we can create those manufacturing jobs here.
So you're pretty positive about the,
I'm pretty positive,
the,
you know,
the president striking the right tone and all that. I mean, yeah.
I think you know, it's striking the right tone. It's reaching out reach out to key leaders. It's also signaling to them that we want to meet them and more than halfway if we need to. But the point is, we need to work together.
Well, I thank you for joining us this morning. Ginger Liu, again, is senior counselor to the White House National Economic Council and joined us from Washington, D.C. Again, appreciate your being with us, Ginger Liu.
Thank you, Michael.
Let me tell you who else is going to be with us in response to the president's speech before the chamber yesterday. Robert Kuttner is co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He joins us this morning. Good morning to you.
And good morning to you.
And David Henderson joins us, research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford. And welcome, David Henderson.
Thanks, Michael. Hi, Robert.
Good to have you both with us, and let's hear a couple more cuts from President Obama's speech before we get some reactions to from both Robert Kuttner from the American Prospect magazine and David Henderson from the Hoover Institution. This is, the president saying in his speech to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that workers must benefit when companies do.
If we're fighting to reform the tax code and increase exports to help you compete, the benefits can't just translate into greater profits and bonuses for those at the top. They have to be shared by American workers.
Well, Robert Kuttner, let's get a response from you to that. It sounds certainly positive about getting companies on the ball here as far as hiring, doesn't it?
Well, first of all, I mean, let's keep in mind who the audience for this speech is. The audience was not the several hundred business executives who were sitting in the room. I mean, the audience was the TV audience at home. And so he is trying to demonstrate to the American electorate via the media that on the one hand, he's extending the olive branch to business, and on the other hand, he's expecting business to invest more at home. But nothing that the president said is going to make the business community make decisions other than those that it makes in terms of what business thinks is sensible for the bottom line. And the problem is that the policies that the business community has lobbied for and that both Democratic and Republican administrations have pursued in trade agreements make it more profitable for business to cut deals with the Chinese and offshore production. And there's nothing that the president said that's going to change that behavior. So it's mainly about optics. It's mainly about commentators being able to say, well, he's meeting them halfway, he's extending an olive branch, and other citizens saying, gee, he's exhorting them to invest more in the United States, but I don't see how it changes anything.
Political speech that will not change anything in your judgment? Or...
Well, and worse than that, speaking as a liberal, he didn't meet them halfway. He met them about 90% of the way. And if you look at the recent speeches of Jack Donahue, the head of the chamber, you know, they're whacking away at the administration on health reform, on banking reform, on tax policy, even on when they should restart drilling in the Gulf, whether or not it's safe. It's not as if they have an understanding that he's going to give the business community tax cuts and some regulatory relief, and in exchange, the business community is going to lighten up on some of the stuff that they're whacking him on. So, you know, as long as he moves in the direction of all the policies that corporate America's lobbyists are pushing for, they're going to treat him nicer. But I'm not sure that's either smart politics or smart economics.
Well, let's talk about the lack of smartness of the economics with you for a moment, because it sounded as if to you he was merely championing the idea of more free trade agreements and less regulation, which is perhaps, I suppose, from your political perspective, got us into a lot of trouble to begin with?
Well, sure. I mean, American business now has a model. And if I can plug my magazine, Harold Meyerson, in the current issue of the American Prospect, has a wonderful piece on how businesses' profits reflect a model where you outsource more and more jobs and you take all the subsidies that China offers, the low wages, the government loans, the slightly coercive efforts to take on Chinese partners. And so business profitability has become disconnected from whether jobs are created at home. That's the fruit of a bipartisan trade policy that's good for business, it's not good for most American people. And I think, secondly, if you look at what caused the financial collapse, Wall Street just went berserk, and regulations were either repealed or not enforced. And then since then, which was the sort of the mother of all regulatory defaults, you know, we've had the blowout in the Gulf, we've had mining disasters, we've had food poisoning, we've had dangerous drugs waved through by the FDA, and a few minor cases on the other side, like saccharin staying on the list of disapproved ingredients. So I credit the president for saying, you know, there are areas where we maybe have too much regulation, but there are also areas where we have too little regulation. But he went way, way over in the direction of the business agenda without getting much in return. And not only is this dubious politics, except in the very, very short run when he gets some favorable commentary, but I don't see how it's going to fix the economy. And that's not good for Obama in the long run. It's not good for the economy in the long run.
Robert Kuttner, again, is co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. We're going to hear from David Henderson, who's a research fellow with Hoover Institution at Stanford. First, let's hear what the president had to say about regulation. And one of the things he said is that regulations aren't automatically something business should oppose.
Not every regulation is bad. Not every regulation is burdensome on business. A lot of the regulations that are out there are things that all of us welcome in our lives.
Well, David Henderson, how did you read the president on regulation?
On regulation or just generally?
Well, let's talk about regulation first of all.
Okay.
I mean, in a sense, what we heard from Robert Kuttner is he was playing essentially the game that maybe more regulation is needed, or less regulation is what we ought to be aiming for.
Yeah, he was pretty vague about that. I don't see him as being suddenly this big deregulator. I mean, there are huge amounts of regulation that have been imposed on Americans by both Bush and Obama. I mean, start with the health care law, which will be a tremendous set of regulations to try to cope with. The Dodd-Frank law, and we're still trying to figure out what that law means. I mean, Nancy Pelosi had that famous line about the health care law, let's pass it and then see what's in it. Well, both for the health care law and the Dodd-Frank, we're still not sure. So she actually was an optimist in saying that. And here's my concern. There was a real mercantilist tone throughout the whole speech, and also in his State of the Union when he talked about winning the future, as if somehow we're competing with China. Well, Paul Krugman used to write really clearly about this in the 90s, pointing out that really countries don't compete. if you want to do well, have general productivity go up, and then there's more there, and people have more. So it doesn't really matter whether China gets 10 times as wealthy as it is, if we get, say, 2 times as wealthy, because we'll be better off. And there really isn't competition between nations the way there is between businesses. And so I think one of my concerns is that one of the things that he will find in common with some of the members of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is these mercantilist plans. So, for example, they might collude together and have certain kinds of restrictions on imports, say for the steel industry or whatever, and that's bad. And so I don't know what he's doing, but one thing I've learned about Barack Obama is he usually does. And so I don't know where he's going with this, but I'm nervous about it.
Well, you don't like the emphasis on competition. You'd like to see the emphasis on productivity. I got that. Let me actually...
Well, I'd like to see the emphasis on getting the government down to size. I mean, when we talk about a budget freeze and it's being frozen at this extremely high level, that's not good. And I think the best thing he could do is to get government spending down, get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan, and get out of all these countries where we have troops. And there you'd probably save $250 billion a year.
All right, again, we're looking at the state of affairs between the Obama administration and the business community in light of President Obama's speech, which was delivered yesterday to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. I want to invite those of you listening to join us. In fact, you can do that now if you have some responses or something you'd like to add to our conversation or any questions or comments. Feel free to join us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. And again, we welcome your calls now at 866-733-6786 for you to join the program. You can also do that by emailing us forum@kqed.org, or you can post a question or comment on our website by simply going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And we're going to go to your calls here forthwith. David Henderson and Robert Kuttner only will be with us probably for another 20 minutes or so. We're going to hear from some other voices as well, but we'd like to hear from yours. And David Henderson, you disagreed with the president also on, well, essentially what might be a sacred cow in many people's minds, investing in the need for higher education.
Right. I mean, if you look at the evidence, well, first of all, most of the benefits of education go to the people who are educated. There's not what economists call a big externality there. And so I think, in fact, that the government spends, and I wouldn't even say invests, some of its investment, but it spends way too much on higher education. And one of the dangers is that we're going to have a lot of people who come out of colleges with degrees and expect that job that starts them at, say, $40,000 a year, and they end up finding one that maybe they earn $25,000 or $30,000 a year, that they could have done pretty much as well without that college education. And so I think what's being set up is this whole generation of people who are going to be very disenchanted. And, in fact, we're seeing that in Egypt. I mean, one of the things going on, and by the way, I think probably what's going on is good. I'm a defender of that kleptobillionaire Mubarak. But one of the things going on is that they've had almost universal free higher education, and they've got this whole generation of people that can't find jobs. And I think that's that we're not close to Egypt, but that's a growing problem, I think, in the United States.
All right. I want to bring our callers in, and let's go right to your calls. Dean, join us. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The gentleman that made the comment about being able to save a big bunch of money if we brought our troops home from Iraq and Afghanistan, the thing that I find really disturbing about business in the United States is that they're willing to sacrifice the welfare of the American people so they can make money. I mean, we're talking about the defense of the nation. In terms of health care, we're talking about making it possible for people that don't have access to health care can get health care. They've estimated that somewhere in the neighborhood of 45,000 people a year died needlessly because they can't get access to health care. I wish American business was actually working for the welfare of the American people instead of just trying to make a buck. I find it really distressing.
Well, I thank you for your sentiments. And David Henderson, clearly the president was trying to defend his health care policy and say to business, let up and don't stand in opposition.
No, I think that's right. I think he was saying that, and I think it's a bad bill. I think it'll make health care more expensive, and I think there are ways of having it be cheaper, like letting people buy health insurance from the lower regulated states where they can get more of a bare-bones catastrophic policy. But the other point the caller made was about defending the nation, and I don't think United States troops are defending the nation over in Afghanistan and Iraq and South Korea. They're defending those countries. I mean, I remember when Bush, in his September 20th speech after 9/11, said that he wanted to defend the homeland, and I thought, well, what have we been paying $300 billion a year for? And it turns out it wasn't to defend the homeland. There's no plan, as far as I know, and I teach at a school that has a lot of military officers. There's no plan, as far as I know, to defend the United States. It's all about being in other countries.
Well, let's hear from Robert Kuttner on the idea that money well spent on it, or money on health care plan of President Obama's is money well spent, and money in Iraq and Afghanistan is money that's wasted.
Well, I agree we spend too much on the military, but I mean, let's talk about the health plan. The Obama health plan was not as efficient as it might have been because there was such wall-to-wall opposition from the business community. And in order to get the legislation through Congress, he had a deal in the insurance companies and he had a deal in drug companies so that business could make a buck increasing the percentage of Americans who have some kind of health insurance. And don't forget, for all of the talk about government-run health care, all of these policies are going to be private insurance company policies off of which industry makes a buck, the insurance industry and the drug companies. So I agree this isn't as efficient as it might be, precisely because of business opposition to a more efficient national health plan that would include a public option. But that said, I think it's better than what we have. I mean, it's gonna you know, increase by 15 or 20 million, the number of people who, more than that, I think it's 28 million, the number of people who have insurance. So, but in an ideal world, it would not be up to the business community, up to individual corporations to provide health insurance for their workers. Now, where we disagree is all of the evidence is that insurance policy that you go out and buy individually are the most inefficient way to provide insurance. And by allowing people to go to states where insurance is lightly regulated, you're more likely to get ripped off. You're more likely to be suckered into buying policies that don't cover you when you get sick. And, yeah, take it off the backs of government, make it just tax-supported so that all American citizens get health insurance the same way all elderly citizens get health insurance. And Medicare is extremely popular because it's extremely extremely efficient. And, you know, this is a sort of an ideological debate. I thought the spat in the family metaphor was really pretty silly. I mean, this is not a spat in the family. This is two people with staunchly held principle differences. The line about, you know, if only I'd gone across the street and brought you fruitcake when we move in, that was a cute line. But to pretend that there are not deep ideological differences, to pretend that the business community does not have an enormous amount of political power, which it's using to try to destroy the Obama administration, unless the Obama administration completely comes around to the views of organized business, you know, is to paper over some real differences that are important.
And here's an email that sort of dovetails with what we just heard from Robert Kuttner. This is from a listener named John. It says, preventing a second Obama term is the highest priority for the Chamber of Commerce. Obama knows this and has no illusion that the business community will act in the national interest. We'll go to more of your calls and bring you into the discussion. Again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 as we talk about President Obama's relations with the business community, outlined and mapped out in his speech last night before the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Again, you can also send us an email to forum@kqed.org or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. In a speech yesterday to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, President Obama argued that government and business have a shared responsibility for the economy. He promised to work to improve the tax code and regulations to give businesses more room to grow, but he also told executives that, and I'm quoting from his speech, businesses also have a responsibility to America, end quote. We're looking at the state of affairs between the Obama administration and the business community. We spoke with Ginger Liu earlier on, senior counselor to the White House National Economic Council. And with us, Robert Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, and David Henderson, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And our callers from Fairfax, Virginia. Ronald, good morning.
Good morning. Michael, my comment is this. I'm a retired government international economist, and I've been following this subject for many years. So during the Cold War, we made many unfavorable trade deals with many countries as long as they were anti-communist. Then when we had trouble with our trade balance with the Japanese, we put in car quotas, which at least brought Japanese companies and jobs for American workers to this country. Don't forget, that's why Honda, Toyota, et cetera, are here. We seem to have dropped those kind of policies to level the playing field as far as the Chinese are concerned. With China, we seem to have a totally pro-business open-door policy with China, which, ironically, is still a communist country. It's bizarre if you think about it. So we seem to have gone to an extreme tilt in our trade policy that takes the U.S. Labor situation, totally ignores our U.S. labor, our unemployment problem.
Well, I'd like to hear Robert Kuttner on this, particularly since we heard David Henderson before opine about the trade situation and competition with China. And where do you stand, Robert Kuttner?
Well, David thought that some members of the chamber were practicing mercantilism, meaning economic nationalism. It's a treat to hear somebody who's to the right of the Chamber of Commerce. Most of the members of the Chamber of Commerce are all too happy to make deals with China that allows them to move production offshore. It's a very interesting system of state-led capitalism by a communist country that also happens, in addition to offering subsidy and coercing technology transfer, offers very, very low-paid workers who are one step above slave labor. Now, David may think that countries don't compete against each other. I mean, one of the conceits of libertarian economists is just to define away countries. But the fact is, China has an industrial system. It has a system of state capitalism. And unlike the communists of old, who couldn't, do anything right in their industry because it was dominated by commissars, the Chinese have come up with this very nimble mix of capitalism and communism that's state-led. And even though libertarian economists will deny it, American workers certainly are up against a system of state-led capitalism. If you go back to American history, the whole of American history is just filled with examples, going back to Alexander Hamilton and Abraham Lincoln and the way we won World War I and World War II, where government invests in technology, government invests in infrastructure so that we can get jobs produced in the United States by highly productive industry. So I think to say that, well, countries don't compete against each other, companies do, I just think that's delusional.
David Henderson.
Well, no, I don't think it's delusional. I do think that Bob's right in the sense that many people in various countries think that they compete. But back to China, I think that, first of all, I think that it is absolutely clear. I think Bob is right on this. This is not some free market economy over there. It's a real interesting and mix of state control and some markets and so on.
It's also an economy that we are deeply and profoundly indebted to.
Right. And so the benefit of trade with China, besides the fact that we get stuff cheap and then it allows us to produce stuff in which we have a comparative advantage, the standard David Ricardo case for free trade that Krugman made so well in the 90s. Besides all that, China now needs us. I gave a talk to all the new admirals chosen in the Navy at the end of October, and they're really worried about China. And I said, don't worry about China. They need us. In order to keep this going, they have to have peace. And one of the things that creates peace is trade between countries. It's not a sure thing. Look at First World War, where war broke out between trading partners. But the point is, all other things equal, and there's evidence on this that various political scientists and economists have found, that all other things equal, the more trade there is between two countries, the more peaceful they are. I think one of the things not remembered is how the whole thing got resolved when the Chinese brought down a plane the first couple of months of the Bush administration, and all these multinationals went to, you know, went to Bush and said, "Hey, don't mess this up. You know, don't get us into a war over this. We can figure this out because we really like this trade relationship with China. Trade creates peace."
Let me get another caller on, and Robert, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. President Obama mentioned in his speech that American business is focused on profits. But what I've noticed as a shareholder is that less and less of those profits are percolating down to the shareholders. I'm an investor from small R&D stage companies to large multinationals. And the trend over the years is compensation or excessive compensation going to upper management and less of the profits being shared by the actual owners of those entities, which are the shareholders. And my question is, what could be done to reverse this structural trend and return more of the profits to the shareholders?
Well, again, David Henderson, you were pretty critical about the president being, well, I hesitate to use the word, but ignorant when it comes to investing in general. I mean, for example, you took him to task on high-speed rail and felt that maybe he didn't really know what he was doing in that whole realm of investment.
Right. Well, I'd like to respond to yours, but then very quickly to the caller. I think the caller is probably right, although I haven't looked at the data carefully, but I remember in the 1980s when there was this anti-leverage buyout movement and various state governments passed laws, poison pill laws and so on, that made it hard to dislodge an existing management. And I remember thinking then, I wonder to what extent management will then take advantage of the shareholders. And I think that probably is what's going on. Now, to your question, Michael, yeah, I think high-speed rail is one of the biggest boondoggles ever if we get it. First of all, it won't be high speed. Second, it'll be expensive. Third, in his State of the Union, President Obama said 85% of people would have access to it. Well, if 85% of people have access to it, it's not going to be high speed because you're going to have to stop at various points. And so I just think that's one of the biggest wastes. We have high-speed transportation between cities. It's called airplanes, and it's way cheaper than what the high-speed rail will be charging, even with all those government subsidies.
Well, two things here, Robert Kuttner. That is the president's wisdom when it comes to investing in general and how shareholders are maybe being, shortchanged or getting less than they have in the past.
Well, on the shareholder point, I mean, this is a criticism that goes back almost 100 years. I mean, the classic book on it was written by Burley and Means in the early 30s. And of course, corporate executives are in a privileged position. They have all kinds of insider knowledge. There was a classic joke from the 20s where an investor is being shown, you know, Morgan's yacht and all the yachts of all the investment people, bankers, in, and he says, "Well, where are the customers' yachts?" And I think, where are the customers' dividends? And I think business has gotten even more adroit in the 90s and in the 2000s at keeping the money for bonuses. And I don't think the way to fix this is to encourage more leverage buyouts, because leverage buyouts produce even more windfalls for insiders. It's to change the tax structure and change the corporate governance structure. Now, on high-speed rail, the problem is that because the chamber and other people who want tax cuts are going to fight the president tooth and claw when it comes to having enough public money to do serious public investment, you know, you're going to get token high-speed rail. You're going to get a little line here, a little line there. We can't even get money to upgrade high-density corridors where the track bed is outmoded, like New York to Boston, where the fastest train ran faster in 1910 than it does today. And the state of public infrastructure in this country generally is a disgrace. I mean, the American Society of Civil Engineers puts the basic deficit of accumulated investments that haven't been made, that should have been made, at $2.2 trillion. So I don't think it's in the cards anytime soon. But, you know, China, with its nimble mix of capitalism and state-led growth, just put $300 billion into high-speed rail. And many European countries have found that for medium distances, 200, 300, 400, 500 miles, high-speed rail is much more efficient than planes. And, of course, the advantage is that they develop the production technology that has spillovers into other kinds of rail technology. We don't even have a low-speed rail industry in this country anymore. We have to buy it from Japan or Germany. And so that contributes to the trade deficit. It also contributes to the deficit of domestic jobs.
Robert Kuttner, thank you so much for joining us on Forum
this
morning. Robert Kuttner, again, is co-editor of the American Prospect Magazine. And David Henderson, thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
David Henderson is research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. We want to get some more response to the president's speech. And Carl Guardino is with us. He's president and CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, which is an organization designed to address major public policy issues that affect Silicon Valley and include CEOs, principal officers, senior managers of prominent Silicon Valley companies. Good morning, Carl.
Good morning, Michael.
Glad to have you aboard. We also have Scott Haughey with us, who's president and founder of Small Business California. They're a bipartisan organization that advocates and provides education for small business. Welcome, Scott Haughey.
Good morning.
Morning to you. Carl Guardino, let me begin with you. Silicon Valley Leadership Group, response to the president's speech?
Well, it was really the tale of two presidents. We applaud the president in his calls for investments in infrastructure, and whether that's transportation from roads, bridges to rail, or communications and education improvements as well. But we would also caution the president, because language matters, and when we continue to hear rhetoric about shipping American jobs overseas, it ignores the reality that 95% of the world's markets are overseas, and we have to have equipment, facilities, and people in those markets in order to compete.
Well, I guess he was maybe taking aim at all the outsourcing that was going, that is going on and has gone on, wasn't he?
Well, that's a boomerang that comes right back at us. So we're sitting here in Silicon Valley, and I'm looking at my window, and I'm seeing Hitachi and Fujitsu and Sony and numerous companies from around the world. And whether it's been NPR studies of the data or Wall Street Journal studies of the data, we have as many companies that are foreign companies with operations in the United States in terms of jobs in the United States as we have American companies with jobs outside of the United States. So we have to be very careful with not only the rhetoric, but those types of policies that could have a boomerang effect in jobs here as well as jobs abroad.
Is there resistance then to the president's notion that there ought to be more job creation responsibility coming from places like Silicon Valley?
The 335 CEOs that comprise the leadership group, and 42% of those companies are less than 100 employees, so a lot of our members are very small innovation economy startups, want nothing better to compete with jobs in California as well as in the United States. In fact, it's why Jerry Brown has asked us for a white paper on how to grow manufacturing and technology jobs in America. We gave him that on January 10th, and why Senator Feinstein asked for that document at the federal level last August, which we gave to her in September, and both of them are moving forward with some of the suggestions that we've made in those white papers. So we want to grow jobs here, but reality is you also have to compete here. So the jobs that make good business sense to keep and grow here, absolutely yes, we're Americans, we want America to succeed. But let's not forget that to be in those markets around the world, 95% of them outside of the United States, you really do have to be there. You have to forge relationships. You have supply chains, raw materials, and everything else to consider. And you have to be in those markets to compete there.
Talking to Carl Guardino, who is president and CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, it struck me that when the president essentially said the key to American success is making new products, that almost was pitched to Silicon Valley.
Absolutely, and the president's right in that regard. Our research and development here is key. His efforts to make permanent the research and development tax credit as well as to make it stronger are right on the dot. And that's why I mentioned it's almost the tale of two presidents, because so many of the policies that he's pushing, we stand up and applaud and work shoulder to shoulder with him. What we want to be careful about, though, is that rhetoric about why we're located around the world. One of the things the president said so effectively, though, Michael, was the fact that our corporate tax code has to come up with what we're competing with OECD nations, those 23 nations around the globe. Japan just lowered theirs, so we now first have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. If you're a California company, it's 39.5%. Second, we're operating as one of the only countries with a world taxation system. So if I'm I'm competing in Ireland, I pay their 12.5%. But to ever bring that money back to America, which our companies desperately want to do, to invest in America, as the president is saying, we're penalized by paying the remaining amount of the 39.5% minus the 12.5% in Ireland, and that means 27% tax burden to bring it home, which companies can't do. Your shareholders would skin you alive, and you can never make up that profit with that big of a differential. A
lot of concern about too much taxing, obviously. let me bring Scott Haughey into this, who is president and founder of Small Business America. And again, they're a bipartisan organization that advocates and provides education for small business. How did the president's speech go down with small business, or how is it related to, as you see things, Scott?
Well, first of all, it's Small Business California, not of America. But really, he wasn't talking to small business. He was talking to the Chamber of Commerce, the CEOs, maybe the audience that was listening to the speech. But there was some discussion of small business around the regulation issue. But for the most part, this was directed to larger companies. As far as small business is concerned, I'm going to pick up on that corporate tax comment because maybe the corporate taxes are too high. I don't want to get into a discussion of that, but one of the concerns that small business has is there was also a discussion of closing loopholes. And that's obviously a pejorative term, but most small businesses are pass-through organizations, so if they close some of the deductions, our taxes aren't going to go down. The corporations may go down, but we actually will pay the same individual tax that we were paying before with some of the deductions eliminated, so we'll actually end up paying more money.
Well, for the most part, I believe President Obama, from your perspective, has done pretty well by small business, hasn't he?
It's a mixed result. He certainly, the passage of the Small Business Jobs Bill was very, very positive. He's been supportive of the SBA and increased the budget, unlike President Bush. He talks about innovation, and clearly that's what small business thrives on.
Talked about wanting to free up capital for small business, too, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's put in $30 billion in his jobs bill, which was a real positive. The negative is that the stimulus money, for the most part in the past, has really gone to larger companies and to bailouts and that type of thing. They are concerned about the health bill. Not necessarily do they all oppose it, but there is a concern because health is, in our surveys that we've done, the number one issue for small business. So there is a concern there. And again, the other concern, going back to this corporate, is he seems to be leaning now back towards corporate America as opposed to smaller businesses.
I'm going to open the phone lines in the time we have remaining. Do you have a business here in California? And what do you think of... Well, the speech, if you had an opportunity to hear it or got access to the text to any degree, you heard some cuts from it here, and you certainly heard a lot of analysis. You may want to put in your response. Also, do you think corporation taxes are too high, which seems to be all in the air here for discussion? If you care to join us, you can do so now at 866-733-6786. That's our toll-free number, and we welcome your phone calls. Again, 866-733-6786, or send us an email, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Talking now with Carl Guardino, President and CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, and Scott Haughey, who is President and Founder of Small Business California. And what did you think about what the president had to say vis-a-vis regulations, Scott?
Well, regulations are a major issue for small business. But also important is, and the president has done, access to capital, I would contend, is even more important than the regulatory issue. The tax code is a mess. Small businesses have all kinds of trouble figuring it out. Regulations go well beyond the federal government. In fact, in the federal government, I believe the numbers were that the smaller businesses pay about $7,200, I want to say, to comply with federal regulations, and the larger companies, over 500 employees, pay about $4,500. So it is a big issue and something that we appreciate his addressing.
Well, again, the Obama administration, though, has eliminated the 1099 provision. That's something that you changed.
Well, he supported it. It hasn't been eliminated. It's coming up, I believe, Congressman Courtney is introducing a measure today that'll be similar to what was passed over in the Senate to eliminate it. Congressman Lundgren has introduced H.R. 4, which is pending, but it has not been eliminated yet. But the president has been supportive of eliminating it.
Do you? I want to get to our callers here, but Carol Gordino, do you see the speeches hastening better relations between business and the Obama administration, or is it just window dressing and political for optics, as we heard earlier from Robert Kuttner?
Communication is always helpful, and I always believe in the best in people when they reach out. So, one, it's good that the president is reaching out and that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, of which we're not a member, is reaching out as well. I want to pick up on the point about regulations as well, because I think the president struck the right chord there, and that's when he said that the perils of too much regulation are also matched by the dangers of too little. And the Silicon Valley Leadership Group has never opposed thoughtful regulation, including AB 32, our Global Warming Solutions Act in California, which we actually endorsed and continue to support. It's finding that balance of not harnessing innovation while you're making sure that you're protecting the health and safety of your workers and the citizens at large. That's a delicate balance, and the president calling for a top-to-bottom review of the regulatory structure on business in Washington, D.C. is a smart step and a helpful step. We just have to make sure that the follow-through is strong and that we find that balance.
And when the president says, Scott Hauge, business must be responsible to America, I assume he's talking to small business as well, isn't he? And does that resonate to small business?
I think small businesses are part of the community, and they do feel a responsibility to the community. I think they volunteer. They provide money to organizations. They do feel responsible, and they do feel responsible to their employees. It is very difficult to have gone through what we've gone through and have to release employees that may have been with us for a lot of years. So they do have the responsibility. The only thing I would say is we don't have the trillions of dollars sitting in our pocket to go out and hire people like some of the major corporations do. We've been struggling for the last few years.
And there was a call, as I said earlier, for those trillions to be used more to get in the game, was how the president phrased it. Here's a listener, Paulette, who says, I'm trying hard to control myself. I live in Silicon Valley and have for 45 years. What I see when I look out my window is empty business parks and rampant unemployment. I have family members and friends who have been out of work 1, 2, 3 years. I also see huge multi-million-dollar homes which have been and continue to be built all along the hillsides and into the valley of these beautiful hills, far away from all of us in the valley, who lose more and more of the American dream. Carol Gordino, when you hear those kind of sentiments, what do you say?
Yeah, I share that caller's concerns, as do our member companies. Our members, large and small, provide nearly one of every three private sector jobs in Silicon Valley, and that's why we continue to try to build bridges to D.C. and to Sacramento, that policies matter. The decisions that are made by our federal and state government actually matter in terms of our businesses, large and small, domestic and multinational, ability to compete and therefore create and grow jobs in California and the United States. And I would refer that caller to our website to pull down our jobs and competitiveness white papers, both at the federal and state level. I think he's going to see a lot that resonates with him that we need to do as employers and employees. I also want to
just mention, for the record, it's a she, but
oh, sure. Thank you. And Michael, I also want to mention a diamond in the rough that you haven't mentioned in the president's speech was around the patent office and the important role that the patent office plays in the innovation economy in Silicon Valley. He mentioned slicing the time, and to his credit, to Commerce Secretary's credit as well, Gary Locke, they're trying to cut it in half, but they're also thinking about regional patent office in Silicon Valley, and what a huge step forward that would be to have engineers talking to patent engineers to move those patents forward more quickly and with better explanation.
Let me get Aaron in here from Palo Alto. Aaron, join us. You're on.
Hi there.
Hi.
I run a business in Palo Alto. It's a software company, and I just have 2 points. The first is that I'm happy to pay my taxes, but they're too complex. I pay 18 different types of taxes right now between payroll, state, federal, and it's a complete nightmare. So that's the first point. The second point is that I'm specifically disappointed with President Obama's initiative for better business investment incentives with a higher past that limit for Section 179, which is expenses you can deduct. And that's great on the federal level, but unfortunately doesn't carry through to all the states. So in California, the limit's still $25,000, and that means anything between $25 and $250, you can never get that deduction again, and you basically just spent a lot of money you shouldn't have. So
well, two important points. Scott Hagee, here's one of your small business owners concerned not only about the tax codes, but also about, disappointment over the business incentives.
Yeah, I think, you know, as far as the tax codes are concerned, remember, small business doesn't have people that's all they do is the larger companies. So larger companies, just by numbers, can make it less expensive.
Well, essentially, were you cheered by what the president had to say about a more equitable tax code? Or did you have some cynicism about it? What was your attitude?
Well, as I said, my problem that I have is the concern that if small businesses are paying on an individual tax rate and they lower the corporate tax rate, that's not going to lower the tax rate for most small businesses, but it will reduce deductions, so they'll end up paying more.
Well, we've come to the end of this hour, and it certainly has been an illuminating hour, particularly where business and government are concerned and the ongoing relationship between the Obama administration and business. I want to thank the two guests that we had most recently on with us, who are still on with us, to say goodbye to Carl Guardino, President and CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group. Carl, thank you for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
And thank you, Scott Hagee, President and Founder of Small Business California.
Thank you.
Thanks also to David Henderson, Research Fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and Robert Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, who were with us for the great portion of the hour, and also to Ginger Liu, who was with us at the top of the hour, who is senior counselor to the White House National Economic Council. And thanks, of course, to you, our listeners. We are grateful for your listenership and wouldn't be here without you. We have another hour of Forum up ahead, where we are decidedly going to shift gears and talk with, one of the not only this nation, but transatlantic and world-famed poet, Evan Bolin, who has a new book out of essays called A Journey with Two Maps. I hope you'll join us for that. Thank you again for joining us for this. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Amy Machado, and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Glover. Okay, we'll skip that one. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.